Just like to start by asking you to give your name and to talk a little bit about where you were born and when and if you came to BC.
Well, I was born in British Columbia in around Princeton, and my name is Marion Sarich, and I've lived here all my life.
Can you talk about when you left school and began to work? Why you left school and what kind of job you started with?
Well, I can't give you dates on that, but I was going to school. I can't even remember, it's such a long time ago, but I had to leave school because I had nobody to send me, which I was an orphan. And then I did go to school. I was in Saskatchewan for a while because my parents moved over there. Then we came back to British Columbia. But then I went to school. I started the school here in Copper Mountain, BC, and they promoted me from grade 5 into grade 7 because I've already done all the work. So, but I only went for about a month, and then I couldn't go any longer, so I more or less had to go to work. I had my first job when I was about 13 or 14 in a private home.
What kind of work did you do?
That was domestic, and it was $5 a month.
Can you describe the kind of chores that you had to do and the hours of work, the conditions?
Oh, yes, I had, I had Thursdays off and every other Sunday, Thursday afternoon. And then I also had, sometimes they'd give me a holiday, but it was an 8-room house and they had 2 children and they were older than I was. And I had to look after them, and I did the semi-cooking, and I did all the housework, all the cleaning. And then they gave me an increase. They gave me $10 a month. And then she said she'd try and give me 15 eventually, but I went back to $5 a month. And so it was very, I was there about 2.5 years.
Why did you go back to $5 a month?
Because of their economics. I mean, he was selling dictaphone machines, and the business wasn't all that good. So she told me that I might have to take a... So I was in the domestic field for 2.5 years there. Then I worked in another place, which was a doctor. And that was... I started with $15 a month. And then she said that she'd give me more, about 25 eventually, see how I work. And then that was 11-room house. But I had to get his breakfast in the morning. He'd ring the buzzer down the kitchen, I'd get the breakfast. And then she'd do the semi-cooking, and I'd have to do, they didn't do much entertaining, but they were a couple that wasn't living together. Actually, one was living in one wing of the house and the other... They decided mutual agreement, and it wasn't pleasant. So I didn't stay there too long, and then I got on as a bus girl in one of the restaurants.
Can I just ask you something about being a domestic? What kind of attitudes did the families have towards their domestic help? Did they include you into the family? Did you eat at the table, or were you
I ate at this first place that I worked at. I ate with her daughter and son, and her husband and her ate in the dining room. That was about the only place that I know, but with the doctor, no, I wasn't allowed to. She'd stand and eat by the doorway in the dining room, and I'd be in the kitchen, and she'd be talking to me, and she says, I shouldn't even be doing this, you know, because you're a servant. And she was a nurse. She was a nurse. She graduated, 1915, I think, at the General Hospital. But she was actually a nurse. I mean, they weren't wealthy, but, I mean, they were comfortably well off in those days. And he was a brain specialist. What they call, I guess, psychiatry. Was born from that, I imagine, you know, in his field. And it was. She didn't. She looked down upon me. When I came in one night after I was off in the afternoon, I came home, And she accused me of making an awful lot of noise coming home. And she said, what do you mean by driving up and making your friends stop there? I wasn't making any noise at all. She said, you're very fortunate to be able to sleep on the same floor as us. You know, we could have you sleeping in the basement room. Most of the servants do, you know, she said. Oh, she was nasty. Really nasty.
Were there other servants?
No, I was the only one. But I was glad to get out of there. I wasn't happy there. So I told her that I was quitting, that I had a job in Bridge River. But I didn't, it wasn't the truth. I just had to get out of there, and I just gave her a story like that. But I didn't like the idea of having to lie about it. You know, I was too young to be aggressive, you know, to say, well, I don't like this job, you know, what you can do with it. I mean, I wasn't that type. And so I tried to handle it the best way I know how, but then she found out that I didn't get the job I told her that I was going to Bridge, and if that didn't work out, I'd get on at the Beacon Theater as an usherette. So she went down to the theater to inquire about me, and she found out that I wasn't working there, that I never did work there. So that was she found out through ways, you know, through domestic help. At one time I was ready to organize domestic servants, you know, I was starting to organize them, but it fell through because a lot of the servants were terrified of their jobs.
When was that you were trying to organize?
In the 30s. You know, they were afraid to. We were all afraid. Actually, I was afraid, but I was willing to go out and organize them, you know, particularly, especially when I went into the restaurants. And then I was a bus girl, and that's when the first strike they ever had in Vancouver was in the middle 30s.
So this period when you were at first working was in the 1930s?
Yes, it was in the 30s, yes.
And did you try and organize then or later on?
There was talk of it. I was going in for the with the domestic servants. We were starting to organize. It was AFL, AFL was the same as something like the Alliance in Canada. They're not, they just sit on their offices and wait for people to come in and join the union. They don't go out, they're not organizers, you know. But any organizing that was done by the rank and file. It was, you know.
How did the domestic organizing campaign get underway? Who thought it up?
There was trade unionists, you know, that at that time there were, just like the farm workers now.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. It started out from just a few people getting together, trade unionists, and by us telling them that what we do and what kind of work we do and how many long hours we work. So they were going to, and particularly during the war too, when they were bringing and importing labor, during the war years, they imported people to come in and work for the big shots. Like they're doing with the boat people now.
Uh-huh.
It's the same thing. And they get these people in their homes, and then next thing you know, they work for peanuts. And these people work from early dawn to late at night. But I was one of the luckier ones that I had that first job because they were more humane than, say, some others were, you know.
Did the unions advertise? Like, did they put out notices that they wanted domestics to come and talk to them about organizing?
Well, you see, my being in the labor movement, being known in the labor movement and knowing people in the labor movement, this came about that we were going to organize the domestic workers. But then I went into the restaurants. I drifted from that to the restaurants, but I was still working on it and trying to get domestic people organized.
How did you become known in the labor movement?
Well, I have been in the trade union movement ever since I've been little, you know. My older brother, he was a very strong trade unionist. And as a matter of fact, he's the one that opened my eyes politically. I mean, I didn't know that much, but I mean, he's the one that that made me realize that about capitalism and about communism and about socialism, and he's an ardent reader of Marx and Engels. And then, of course, he followed up. He was an unfortunate incident because he had to quit school when he was 3 or 4. And he ended up when he was in the, it's very sad because he was very brilliant, very he had a keen mind, very keen mind. And he said you probably, he was a tubercular. When they were rounding up in the 30s, when the conservatives were in power, and they were going to, they were summing the provincial governments to saying that the TB patients should all be, the men should be castrated. That's the truth. And he was sent from the general hospital to DeRoche, BC, which was only tent camps. There were tents, and this is where he lived as a TB patient. This is where he was in the hospital, because it's cheaper to keep them there than it is to have them in the general hospital. So he had a very difficult time, and he was 5 years in the hospital on and off. He had contracted pleurisy, and then from that he went to work. He left the hospital, and then he got a job on the gang. Working on the gangs during the conservative rule.
With tuberculosis.
He hadn't fully recovered, and then he had a relapse because he worked so hard. And it was very difficult for him. Then he contracted TB, you see, and this is one thing that you have to be very careful of. It could get worse, you know, in the relapse. So he did, and he spent most of his time in the, I think he was about 29 or 30 when he died. And he had a very tough time, you know, and it looks like my dad died of silicosis. And there was absolutely no compensation then whatsoever. And they just died, and that was it. Got no revenue, no nothing, no welfare. There was no welfare. The only way that people helped was help one another. If somebody else had a little bit more money, they helped their friends. This is how people got by.
So your dad was a miner?
Yes, my dad was a miner. He mined at Phoenix, he mined at Headley, he mined at some of these Copper Mountain, and he mined in Phoenix. That's where they had a big boarding house. Mm-hmm. And he worked all those years, and then the doctor told him that it wouldn't be a good idea for him to quit mining. And when he was in South Dakota mining, he moved to, well, he was in British Columbia, but he moved back into British Columbia, and they said, wouldn't it be better if you went farming than going? No, he wanted to go mining because that was all he knew. So then when he did go farming, well, apparently my mother took very ill because of the change of the climate, and then she was bedridden for about 3 or 4 years, what I know of. I don't really know very much, but what my older sisters told me. And there's only two of us living, a family of 10. You know, so it's been very, very hard, you know. It's a struggle all the way. So then he went to Saskatchewan, then he died over there, and then we came all back, the rest of the remaining, except for two sisters stay there. Then the one came back, and the other one stayed in Saskatchewan, and she died just last November. I went to visit her last year, and her two sons are over there, my two nephews, living in Saskatchewan. But she was always going to come over here and join the rest of the family, but she never did. So it's kind of sad. But it was a struggle. The whole family struggled.
Right. So you grew up with that kind of consciousness that life was really difficult?
Well, it was, but I didn't want to let it get me down. I was high-spirited. You know, I always figured there's around the corner, there's got to be something better. You know, you just can't, you can't bury your head in the sand. You just go, life goes on. You know, you can't get scary.
So you learned about trade unionism primarily through your brother?
Yes, to start with, yes. And then when we worked in the restaurant, we started to organize. And this Bill Bill
Stewart,
yes, Bill Stewart. He was in the union, and we started to organize, and there was about quite a few of us girls that started. I was a bus girl. I was working 7 days a week at, I think it was, I don't know whether it's 25 cents an hour, or then we were asking for 50 cents an hour, I think. But we all worked 7 days a week. But they worked, they weren't allowed to work us over 8 hours, but they did. They worked us over eight. But they try to work us under eight and give mm-hmm. us 3/4 of an hour for lunch or something like that. But you were still on the premises. You couldn't leave the place. So we started organizing, and we had a strike. It was on for a whole week. And we counted, there was 35 people of public went in to eat.
What
35
place did you...
Trocadero Cafe on Hastings Street. It's just near the old province building. And there was, we had wonderful support. We had lawful, the public was behind us 100%. And we had strike pay from the donations from the public. And then, of course, my sister and I were both blacklisted after that. We couldn't get a, none of us could get a job in any of the restaurants because we didn't get back in there. He agreed to not to, that he wouldn't take us back. So it wasn't a victory, actually, but it was. We put the restaurant thing on the map, you know.
Did you get a union in there?
Yes, we got a union. We did get a union in there, but it was split. We were split, you know, because we couldn't get back in again, you know. We couldn't. He wouldn't have us back in again. And he'd have some of them back. He said that we were instigators, we were agitators, and he wouldn't have us back. So we were blacklisted, and they were all Greek owners then at that time, restaurant owners. And once you got on their bad list, you stayed on their bad list. So my sister and I were both blacklisted. So then I had to try and get a job in a hotel clerking, not clerking, but chambermaid, and that was through people that we knew that owned the hotel. And then I worked 7 days a week there, and I worked from early morning till late at night, doing 4 and 5 floors. So I was tickled to death to get a job,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was about $7 a week. $7 or $8 a week. So then I was able to get on in the restaurants. I was able to get on as a. I learned as a waitress after that. Learned how to wait on tables. Well, he did try to train me a little bit. This chap where we struck, you know, but. He was more hurt than he was anything else because he never thought anybody would ever do that to him because he tried to be a fair man. He tried to be, well, in some ways, when I look back and think about it, he was a lot more fair than some of them,
mm-hmm.
you know. But we were determined we were going to start the campaign going by organizing restaurants. So then I was, like I say, I was in the local 28 and then... I was in the restaurant business or working in the restaurants, and I was a waitress, and then I was a shop steward in every place I ever worked. We did a lot of organizing, and it was all voluntary. We didn't get paid for that from the AFL. And there, we used to always say to them, well, how about joining the bartenders and the waitresses union, waiters and waitresses union, and become all one unit, then we'd have more clout. Oh, they wouldn't hear of it. Now they've done that. Since in the last 3 or 4 years, they've done that. They've amalgamated, which we've been talking about for years. Then we had it. We organized it from. There was 200 to 300 members. We organized to 1,200. And then that was just through us, our own organizing. And then you know what they did to us? They accused our business agent of being communist. And that was the Red Scare. And then they slapped a trusteeship on us. The international representative came here and they seized all our books and seized everything, and we couldn't get access to anything. And then we had meetings with our international representative, and I just about got sick at the meetings, how he twisted everything, because he wasn't with us. I mean, those people aren't with us. Hugo Ernest, the president of the American of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees in the States, was a rebel himself when he first came to the United States when he was organizing. He said, I asked him once, I said, well, what type of person would you consider would be the best for organizing, a communist? He says, who else? Because they organize and they don't even get paid for it. And this is the way he looked at it. And he said, I had an awful lot of fights in the United States, he says, but he became a president. He became a president, but he was a good president, though. He was a lot better than some of them. Some of them are real reactionary. The ones that are in there now, I imagine, are very, very reactionary. So, of course, it's just like the Canadian Seamen's Union. There was another. We were very active in that, in organizing. And when we went to Victoria to the 1948 convention, I think it was, there was three of us sisters from the local, paid our own way. And we were accused in the House at the convention of taking dictation from Kremlin, because we stood headstrong. We wouldn't vote which way the reactionaries voted to seat the SIU. See, we voted against the SIU, so our international representative tried to buy us out by offering us a hotel suite at the Empress, and that they wanted our votes, and we stuck to our guns, and they couldn't buy us, and our international representative had a stroke. He had almost had a heart attack. He ended in the hospital. He was so angry with us because he couldn't switch us over to vote the way he wanted us to vote. And they weren't seated, so Percy Benghoff, the president of the Trades and Labor Congress, he was 100% behind the Canadian Seamen's Union. See, that what you see, the AFL, the Canadian Seamen's Union was never organized by the SIU. And they're the ones that figure they had the jurisdiction in Canada, but they never did organize. So the men took things into their own hands and started organizing. There was a Canadian union, bona fide 100% Canadian union. So they were out to smash it, and they got all their goon squads and banks and all them, and they smashed it. They smashed. And then we had, unfortunately, we had people that were strong CSU that were bought over, because some of them were alcoholics, and the bosses were able to buy them out. You know, there was quite a few of them. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. That's where labor falls down, you see, when you're drinking, you see, that's not helped the situation any, but it broke my heart when that, they were 12,000 strong when they were organized. And Harry Rankin would tell you plenty of that, because he was going to UBC then. He was studying law. And we used to go down to the Stanley Park and get a great big huge blanket, and we'd go all over to the people and ask for donations to support the strike. But that was quite an experience I had in Victoria. You know, if unions are political, well, eventually this SIU won over, and they dismantled the CSU completely. So then they joined hands together later on, but it's, I can't quite remember just exactly. I think there was another organization joined in with the SIU, and they're still battling, I think. They're still battling. But it's...
Were you an organizer for them?
No, I wasn't an organizer, but I was a supporter.
Did you work in areas that they had jurisdiction over, or...?
No, I didn't work. I was never, and I never worked at sea. Like, I mean, there were some. They've got all the ferries, I think, and they had Northland Navigation, and they organized. But they didn't organize until CSU organized, and then they stepped in and said, oh, that's our jurisdiction. That was a jurisdictional fight all the time. But they never did anything. They never organized. You know how the FFL is? Mm-hmm. You know, they're not. Then that's how come the CIO, Lewis started the CIO, because they were never getting any results from the FFL. You know, it's just it's a craft union, and it's a company union, almost like a company union. And they were always a little bit afraid, just like the Alliance is today. You know, but now the Alliance is coming forth now. Now, if they had done this with us in the post office, we would have been that much stronger now had they joined hands with us. But they were afraid of their jobs. We put our jobs on the line in 65 in the post office. We thought we were all going to be fired. Every one of us.
Were you tried to organize?
Yeah, well, we went out in that Wildcat in 65, and we stayed out almost a week. But that at least triggered the Mont Petit. They had the Royal Commission, and the Liberals, they're the ones that started that, and they're the ones that gave us our right to strike. Whether they did it willingly or not, but at least Pearson, he was just absolutely flabbergasted after they had that, after Mont Petit had handed in the report. They couldn't believe that such conditions existed in this day and age. Well, you know yourself, when I said that it, 7 years, no raise, well, you can imagine what it was like. And then if you wanted a week off, you took it on your own. You weren't paid for it. But then the Alliance eventually got us a 1 week at 2%. But then that's when the Alliance member says, well, at least the Alliance got us our holidays anyway. So after we joined it was quite a riot joining the CUPW in there too, because there's so many people that were afraid. And when I was helping to organize the part-timers into CUPW, and they said, well, we'll wait and see which way the wind blows. I said, it'll be too late then. Because I said, what we have to do now is organize and go into CUPW now that we're allowed to be members. I said, because in order to get certified, we need the balance. So that's the only way we can do it. But that was a tough one. That was very tough. It still is, as a matter of fact.
Were all the women who worked there then part-timers?
The ones that I was part-time and they were part-time. Then there was casuals. Mm-hmm. And there's the attitude sometimes that the full-timers and the part-timers have towards the casuals. I was a casual, and it makes me very unhappy, because they're human beings too, and they have to work for a living, and it's the bosses that create this terrible tension among the workers, you know, because they try to overload by having more casuals and less of us, because casuals was cheap labor. Well, what we try to do in CUPW is to keep the casuals on the same wavelength as us wage-wise, so that they wouldn't use them for cheap labor. See, whether that was good or bad or indifferent, but it was very hard, and they're talking about bringing back casuals, because they can start them at $3.50 an hour. See, so if we had kept a few casuals at the same rate as we're getting, we probably would have been, but they let them go anyway. So you see, they got us beat.
Okay, can we just sort of roll back and go through each organizing campaign you were involved in sort of successively?
The only one that was in Local 28 that I was a member of, and I was a member of CUPW,
right.
And that's the but I organized in other unions. I was in the cannery unions helping to organize. We tried to organize the 5 and 10s, Woolworth stores. We tried to organize and I worked at Canada Packers. I was also a member of the packing house workers.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a bit more about, I guess, each one as we go through. Going back to the domestics, was there support for organizing the domestics from outside the labor movement at all? People like Helena Guttridge or...?
Yes, there were, as a matter of fact, there was the I'm just trying to think of the women that were the women's movement. Mildred Dugan was in that, and
was it the Housewives League or
the Housewives League was one of them, and then there was also another group of women. There were auxiliary women auxiliaries.
Mm-hmm.
Of all descriptions, and it was all working class, you might say, that were trying to organize and help. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be a member, but it was. Then we had the unemployed, the organized unemployed. We also had them, and my brother belonged to that, and organizing the unorganized. You know, all the ones that were unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when they were out at camps, they were working. My brother was working for 15 cents an hour. Well, when Mackenzie King became prime minister, he raised it to 25 cents an hour. So you see what at least mm-hmm. that was better than what the conservatives did, because they weren't going to raise it to 25 cents. But that's the whole Women's League. The Women's League and then there was a league against war and fascism.
Right, that started in the late
80s. Yeah, and then there was the League for Peace and Democracy. There was a lot of little groups of organizations coming into the pictures constantly.
Okay, around the domestics, did these different groups get together, like the Women's Labor League and the Housewives League and so on, and form an organizing committee?
They went all over the province, you know, to organize the domestic workers, because there was quite a few domestics. There were a lot of people in that, and we were trying to quite a few times when I was in the movement. I was pushing to organize, and I still was not as active then when I got into the restaurants, because I started building up in the restaurants, in the union, hotel and restaurant employees union, trying to organize there, you see. But I still try to help.
Right, okay. And how would you try and reach domestic workers? What kind of publicity would you do?
Well, we'd find out, I'd know some of them, and then they would, I would get them to meet me, and then they'd bring some of their friends, domestics that they knew, and I'd meet them, and then we'd all meet and meet at somebody's home.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever had a home that could sometimes we meet in a restaurant.
Right.
You know, it just depends wherever we could meet, you know.
Were domestic workers generally immigrant women, or were
No, a lot of them were Canadians. So, yes, there were immigrants, but there was more Canadians at that time. There was more Canadian women, that young girls, you know, that have no homes. And
mm-hmm.
And then there was, like I say, there was European women too, and they were some of them, if they were aggressive enough and they wanted better wages, they'd join us. And then there were some that they didn't want to. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They say, "Well, what'll happen to me if I lose my job? Then I won't have a job."
Right.
You know.
So then, would you like sign them up, give them union cards, or?
Well, what we did was we rounded them up, and then we got there was the league, or it was the Women's League, and the Housewives that were going to get, once we got these people rounded, then we'd try to get a charter for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it also would be the FFL, the domestic workers. But where would they fall into, you see? What category would you fall into? Because they'd say, well, that's our jurisdiction. They couldn't come into the waitresses. You know, they couldn't, the domestics. So I suggested that why not bring the domestics into the hotel and restaurant employees? Because they work in hotels. It's like a domestic.
Mm-hmm. It's like chambermaid.
Yes, chambermaid. And they said, no, well, that's another category again. And there was a disagreement there about who'd get the jurisdiction, where would they come into, where would they fall into. So I said, well, why not miscellaneous? You know, bring them in under miscellaneous then. But it was to getting them, and you know, when you get people like that and you start organizing, you got to see that you got to act fast,
mm-hmm.
because people fall apart. You know, they don't. They become frightened.
So the unions themselves acted as almost a block to organization.
Well, in some ways, because they could never get... See, this is your AFL teachings and your school of the AFL. It's narrow, and you see, that's why we like the CIO. That's why the CIO, you're industrial. You see, you're organized from the basement to the top stairs, and this is what we wanted. We wanted this all along, you see. But the only way you could do that is to join the CIO.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see, when you're organized, the FFL would fight and say, well, that's our jurisdiction, you see. And there was this jurisdictional disputes all the time that used to irk me. They wasted so much energy and time just over nonsense, you know.
Who did you finally join, the domestic workers?
Well, then I it escapes me for the moment now. I have to think back. I'd have to think back to that. It might, but there's several friends of mine that might know. They may know. I might be able to help you in the future,
right,
on this question.
What demands did the domestics organize around? What kind of issues?
Oh, shorter hours, every other weekend. Every other weekend, and then a weekday afternoon off, and they asked for a day off, the whole day off, but they thought that maybe that was a little bit too much. Should ask for an afternoon off, maid's afternoon off, and these other things, and $25 a month. From beginning of five, and then it depends on how long, after 3 or 6 months you get an increase to 35. This is what we were asking for the domestics.
Were you able to establish those kinds of contracts?
Well, they got after the war, after the outbreak of the war, that's when it started to really pick up, because they were willing to pay that,
mm-hmm.
you see. After the outbreak, well, then they were willing to, because they wanted to get servants, you see, and then, as I say, then they started to import people. They were bringing people in.
Did you use a hiring hall, or what kind of methods did you try and use to, I guess, control the labor supply of domestics so that you could set those kinds of conditions? Is there anything like that?
Well, there were several agencies. They had the agencies that hired people out. Mm-hmm. The domestics would go to this agency. I've gone through the agency myself, and they'd send you on jobs. But they were an agency within themselves. They didn't want their people that they were sending on jobs. They didn't want them organized. See, they were not with us on the agencies. They were on their own because they were, well, they were an agency.
Right.
And that's what they were in. They were in there for the money part of it.
Who would pay them, the employer or the employee, to find a job or a servant?
The employer. Well, an employee too. It depends on the agency, who the agency was. You know, there were all kinds of them.
Right. So would you try and, like, organize all the domestic workers within a particular agency and then set a standard wage?
Well, there was quite a few agencies, you see, where they're sending out people on jobs, and they'd be sending them out of town too, you see. And it was awful hard. We were scattered.
must have been really hard to organize people who were working in.
Yeah, it's very scattered, very, very scattered. It's hard to meet. I was successful in meeting few of the girls that I knew that were domestics themselves, like myself. And then some of them would say, well, we're living in British Columbia. We had a better job back home. We're going to go back home. You see, it's just like the bank people today. A little similarity, mm-hmm. You know. Just when you think you've got them, well, then something. That's why you had to act fast in those days, right. You know.
So did the campaign kind of go through cycles?
I would say so, just like it did with the Woolworth stores, organizing them and getting in to talk to them and being on that. And then we had a picket line out here, the first picket line, but you could only picket one store, you see. You can't picket all the other stores. You can only picket one store.
Why was that?
Well, because the law was that's where the strike is. It doesn't matter if it's a chain. It has nothing to do with the other stores. So I always used to say to them, the only way you're ever going to organize them, if you are ever going to organize the Woolworth workers, is to organize each and every store and then have a general strike. But that was very difficult. They were afraid of their jobs, and they still pay scab wages. Mm-hmm. They still do to this day. So does the Army, Navy. We tried organizing Army and Navy too. It was very difficult. Woodward's, we tried Woodward's when this Barbara Stewart was working for Woodward's. We tried to organize in there too, but it was as soon as they found out you were fired. You know, you didn't. As soon as they found out, I never worked for Woodward's, but I was willing to help to organize.
Do you remember approximately when it was that people were trying to organize the? I guess the retail outlets, was that in like the late 30s?
I would say it was the late 30s and the early 40s. Don Maxwell was one of the organizers. And what's his name that worked for the News Herald? I don't know if he's still with us or not. Barry Mather. And there was another one. All three of them went overseas and they all came back. Mm. And I don't know whether Don Maxwell was killed overseas or not, I don't know, but he started to organize a retail clerks union. The Bay was the first one, I think, to be organized, the Hudson Bay.
So you helped them work on that campaign?
Well, I helped to the, when I was in the, wherever there was any organizing, we were always there to help, to organize, to round up, to get to know the people, to meet them and bring them in and introduce them. And then there was in the building trades and wherever we were needed, you know, we'd go there and we'd find out what we can do to help.
Was that because there was sort of a body of organizers of people who had experience?
Yeah, there was people that wanted to organize. They wanted workers to get a better share. And they were constantly organizing, and the women were, particularly women, they were always on the scene. You know, women were always trying to organize women, and it's very tough organizing women. It's not easy. Because I found that out through time. It's unfortunate, but sometimes men are easier to organize. See, I paid my own coffee money when I was organizing Local 28. I'd meet with the people that worked in the non-union restaurants, and I'd meet with them, and I'd go in and ask for one of the girls that I knew, and then I'd say, how would you like to meet me, you know, after work? What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to talk to you. And some of them would. Some of them would get cold feet. But some of them would be for the organizing right away. Yes, they're making good money in that restaurant. I think they can pay us better wages. But then, like you do all the time now, you get people that will cooperate, and then you'll get people that won't cooperate, you know.
So did you become known when you were organizing restaurants as an organizer?
Well, I wasn't a professional paid organizer. I was a sort of a standby kind of an organizer that I wanted to see. I wanted everybody to be in the union. See, I was trade union conscious.
Right.
And I wanted all these people that I said, you'd have a much better life, you'd be more protected. And, well, what difference does it make? You know, you get these arguments all the time. What difference does it make? If they want to lay you off, they're going to lay you off. But I said, they have to lay you off. They have to answer to the union. They have to prove themselves first. But you're a little bit more secure there. But then I have to pay dues, don't I? You see, and there was this argument sometimes that you have to pay dues, just like they do today. Among the workers in the post office, they're complaining about having to work. I said, well, you can't run a union on shoestrings. I said, you have to pay dues in order to for the union to function.